Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Joan Didion and John Donne. Joan Didion and John Donne were married in 1964 and began a 49-year marriage and writing partnership. They collaborated throughout their lives on writing projects that included high-profile journalism that included magazines like The New Yorker, major motion pictures, or dozens of award-winning books, each published separately under their own names. They were trailblazers who were among the first writers to be successful both in New York literary circles and in Hollywood's film industry. In 2003, Donne died of a heart attack at just 71. In 2005, Didion and Donne's daughter died at the age of just 39. This devastating time resulted in Didion's celebrated memoir, The Year of Magical Thinking, which was a New York Times bestseller, won the National Book Award, and was turned into a Broadway play starring Vanessa Redgrave. Let's listen to these two legendary writers talk about their writing process, collaboration, career experiences, and examine what it means to tell the truth. Here's Joan Didion and John Donne in 1992 as part of Portland Arts and Lectures at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall.
Thank you for coming. I lead off, rather than Joan, this is a gentleman before ladies, because I'm the more scared. That leaves Joan another 20 minutes or so to get scared herself. I am thrilled that you would have us here, because as most of you know, we did spend 24 years living in Los Angeles. And in Los Angeles, we always heard the refrain, "Do not Californicate Oregon." So we are thrilled that you welcome these two former Californicators who now live in New York. I would love to go on like this for a good long time, because it would spare me from talking about writing. And you see, I'm so nervous, I have the wrong glasses on. And writers would rather talk about anything than talk about writing. William Faulkner once said that a writer's obituary should read, "He wrote the books, then he died." Allowing for the Faulkner caveat, let me state a few basic precepts. I am a writer. I am a professional writer. I write to make a living. This is what I do. I do it the same way some of you make your living as lawyers or teachers or executives or engineers or investment analysts or doctors or contractors or entrepreneurs or bureaucrats or even as remittance men. Writing is my job. It is the only job I have. I would just like to make one thing clear. Joan does not write in 16-pound bond paper anymore, nor do I. We both write on computers. So, it is the only job I have, except for the occasional lecture. What I can never ignore when I sit down and to write, the English novelist Paul Scott, he wrote The Raj Quartet, as good a book as you can get on World War II, and on which the PBS series The Jewel and the Crown was based. What I can never ignore when I sit down to write is that I am someone born in my age, subject to its pressures, prejudices, and expectations, scorched by its past, living in its present, fascinated by its future. The duty of a writer, this is Paul Scott again, is to expose to public view his private view of what reality is. Because every novel, every piece of reporting is only an extended metaphor of the writer's view of life. I'm going to give you one more quote here, which I hope will be my last quote, unless I can ring in Henry James later in the evening. And if a writer talks about writing without quoting from Henry James on writing, then you should get your money back. Anyway, this quote is from an English critic, Walter Allen, who is trying to address the question of what makes a writer write. Quote, "Part of the impulse that drives the novelist to make his imitation world," he says, "must always be the sheer delight in his own skill in making it. Part of the time he is, as it were, taking the observed universe to pieces and assembling it again for the simple and naive pleasure of doing so. He can no more help playing than a child can." So writers are essentially children, which might come as a surprise to Mr. Quayle, but then again, perhaps not. Anyway, this evening is called Observing, and is how writers observe and then apply their observations to Paul Scott's rigid formulation, in other words, the pressures, prejudices, and expectations of his or her age. If you observe, you also experience, and so observation might also be called experience. And it's because one is subject to one's own pressures, prejudices, and expectations that two people can observe or experience the self-same thing and see two entirely different things. Let me give you an example. In 1982, John and I went to El Salvador. We had credentials from both Rolling Stone and the New York Review of Books, but we really didn't know if we wanted to write about it. And if we did write about it, which of us would do it? And if we did it, would it be fiction or nonfiction? We went there because we thought it was a place we should see, and we weren't satisfied with what the newspapers were telling us. Anyway, who was going to do what was shaken down in a day or two. I was turning over a novel in my head, and Joan wanted to write about what this benighted place looked and smelt and felt like. Now, here is the interesting thing. We were there for several weeks. We were together 24 hours a day. We interviewed the same people, saw the same thing. A body lying by the side of the road on the way to Morazan province, with a bullet hole drilled neatly between his eyes and his body stripped naked. The morgue in San Salvador. There had been six victims of death squads the night before. The local morticians patched the bullet holes in their faces with some kind of orange wax that gave them a strange, weird, mottled look. Because the heat had already made the bodies turn green and only the orange wax remained a constant color. But when we got home and wrote up our notes and then compared our notes, we discovered, and this is the interesting thing, that there was almost no overlap. I don't mean that as if we'd been to two different countries or that one of us got the picture and the other didn't. We noted the same incidents. It was just that we focused on different things. And I should say here that the difference in our notes had nothing to do with gender. For example, we went one afternoon to the presidential palace to interview the chief of state. Later, when we compared our notes, it turns out that I had concentrated on the furniture and the liveries worn by the palace servants and the silver salver in which official messages were delivered to the president and the china in which the tea was served. It was Limoges, Haviland. Joan's notes are about agricultural reform. The day we saw that body lying by the side of the road on our way to Morazan province, I posed a question in my notebook. The question was, quote, if you are a member of a death squad and you kill someone, drill him between the eyes, strip off his clothes, and leave him naked by the side of the road, what do you do for the rest of the day? End quote. Now, obviously, I was not going to go looking for a member of a death squad and ask him. If I had, I would have wound up with orange wax filling out the bullet holes in my face. I had to imagine the answer, and this is what writers do. Act upon what I had observed, and here it is from the Red, White, and Blue. The speaker is a radical lawyer named Leah Kay, and she is talking about a young American Catholic nun who had been assassinated in a benighted country that bore more than passing resemblance to El Salvador. I'm going to say the real words, so I hope you don't mind. Quote, it was 2 days before anyone at the church knew where she was. That's when I was called. A dog had apparently found the grave and ate a couple of fingers while he was at it. They were sticking up through the dirt. Obviously, she had been buried in a hurry. Her face was shot off. It was as if it had never been there. She had also been raped. Whether it was before she died or after, no one is sure. Forensic pathology is not a science much favored down here. The operative rule is get the body into the ground before the cholera epidemic breaks out. Someone said the shooter was wearing a Mickey Mouse sweatshirt. Not that somebody will ever testify to that in court. I wouldn't hold my breath waiting for that. I suppose the man in the Mickey Mouse sweatshirt went home, played with the children, ate dinner, shit his wife, and went to sleep. I had the answer to the question in my notebook. Joan and I are often asked if we ever use these powers of observation on each other. The answer, of course, is yes. In her fiction and in mine, usually in tiny little ways available only to each other. A tick, a way of dress, a figure of speech, a moment shared, an argument best forgotten. I know when she does it to me, she knows when I do it to her. Do we mind? Sometimes. Do we complain? Sometimes mildly. Is it always accurate? In terms of the work in question, almost always. Do we ever ask redress? Never. It is what we do. It is what we brought to each other. And as Walter Allen said earlier, we can no more stop doing it than a child can stop playing. Occasionally, however, we find ourselves as the observed rather than the observer. I have to admit that it is somewhat disconcerting. I want to quote from a book written a few years ago by an acquaintance of ours, a novelist and nonfiction writer, and a former and very good Vietnam correspondent for the New York Times. Years before, Joan had known him right after his graduation from Harvard, when she was seeing a Harvard classmate and a close friend of his. We were not named in this book, but it does not take 007 to figure out who he was talking about. And I quote, "One Sunday I took the afternoon off," he writes, "and drove out the Pacific Coast Highway for lunch with two writers, husband and wife, who I knew casually. They were a compatible pair, for each was a master of the alchemy that transmutes every slight anxiety or neurosis into a bestseller. I found them surprisingly stable and good-humored. And if they had a fault, it was a tendency to treat Weltschmerz a bit proprietarily. This day, I barely ventured a word about my hesitation over the novel I was then working on, when the husband of the wife reassured me with a vivid account of his or her latest breakdown. It far overshadowed any mild depression of mine, and it was forming the foundation of his or her new book of fiction or nonfiction. When I finished with the commiseration and congratulations, I tried again. Your problem, the husband corrected me languidly, is that you don't want to make $1 million. That ended our brief appearance in the book. I thought about the passage for a long time. Years ago, Joan had written a line, probably the most quoted line she ever wrote, that said, "Writers are always selling somebody out." What she meant, and I think the line is always misunderstood, is not that a writer will always betray his subject, but that the writer's view of a person, no matter how complimentary, will never correspond to that person's view of him or herself. And it was in that spirit that I contemplated those few paragraphs. I had only one real objection, and that was to the adverb languidly in the sentence, "Your problem," the husband corrected me languidly. That happened 20 years ago. In those 20 years, my shape has not changed all that much, and mine is not a shape nor a personality given to languor. But beyond that, as he had been observing us, we both had been also observing him. Remember, it is what we do. I pointed this out in a letter I wrote to him after I read the book. Actually, to be perfectly honest, I never got beyond that passage about us. Anyway, this is the letter. "Dear Jack," I wrote, "it is strange how any writer's vision is viewed through a different prism of selfishness or self-centeredness, as the case may be. My perspective of that Sunday," and I should say here that the Sunday in question was 3 years before the book came out, "my perspective of that Sunday on the Pacific Coast Highway was of an all-pervading gloom, of deadly silences that words couldn't breach, of the watchers, for we are all three watchers, being watched, of the sexual connection between two married people being almost clinically observed by a third writer who had just written a novel on wedlock. I tried to write the scene in my last book, but I couldn't capture the acute discomfort, and I threw it out. Joan, on the other hand, had this sense of failing to make a connection with someone she had met at another time, someone with a girl named Muffy or Puffy. Someone who was a friend of the man she was then seeing and was never going to marry. And that someone who was you, who was once you, disapproving. It was early dinner and not lunch you were invited out for, and you didn't stay. The dinner was all made: artichokes, cold chicken, brie, strawberries, and sour cream. And we were supposed to go down to the beach and have a drink at Jules Pfeiffer's and then come back. But instead you got into your car and went home. She couldn't figure out if the disappearance was directed at Jules or was the residue of that other time, that other place. She couldn't make the scene work either, although I got the menu from her notes. Best, John. Now the fact of the matter is that except for my putative languor, we were all three right, in the sense that we all three came upon that late September afternoon with our own pressures, prejudices, and expectations. What the writer does is observe, and then he filters. Observation is nothing without an intelligence to translate it. I would like to add just one obiter dictum here that has more to do with Joan than with the subject at hand. And that is the menu I mentioned, the artichokes, the chicken, the brie, and the strawberries. Years ago, when she was at Vogue, she worked in the Vogue book of menus. And as a result, she to this day keeps a folder that holds every menu of every meal she has ever served to guests and all the years that we've been married, all neatly typed out, listing the guests, the date, and what she served. She claims she does it in order to have a record for the Internal Revenue Service. Which, in fact, did audit our taxes every year between 1971 and 1983. I would say she would do it anyway because she has a compulsion for order. I suppose I could say that she is an anal retentive, but I just hate the phrase. Anyway, the result is that whenever I need a dinner scene, I go to her menu notebook. In other words, she takes your material where you finds it. I should also add that I once poached a funeral service from her. I needed an Episcopalian service for the red, white, and blue, and Joan had typed one and left it in her own prayer book in the event of a sudden misfortune, right down to the hymns and psalms she wanted, with a specific injunction not to use the 23rd psalm, which she has always hated. Passive crap, she calls it. She wrote out her own funeral service in the same compulsively logical way that she writes out menus. She did not like my using it, but on the other hand, she did understand that my character would have the type of funeral she wanted. I did not, however, use the phrase passive crap about the 23rd Psalm. Joan had a character of her own use it in her novel, Democracy. I guess that what I am saying is that this is part of the baggage carried by writers who are married to or live with each other. But I should also say that in all the years we've been together, we have never argued over material in the sense of who gets what. It is like what happened in Salvador. We saw the same place. We saw different things. It has been ever thus. Occasionally, I read something and I realize that the writer is writing about a situation or about people that I have written about and observed, and that he has another slant on experiences we have shared. Let me give you an example. There is a new book out by Richard Rhodes, which is called Making Love. Mr. Rhodes is an almost exact contemporary of mine. He went to Yale, I went to Princeton, in roughly the same time frame. A few years ago, he wrote a very good book called The Making of the Atom Bomb that won him both the Pulitzer Prize and a National Book Award. We have never met. We have never corresponded. Making Love, Mr. Rhodes' new book, is essentially his sexual biography. I should say here that writers, men more so, I think, than women, are almost compulsively drawn to their own sex lives and getting it down on paper. It is a failing of middle age, when perhaps the memories are better than the real thing. You see, everyone thinks they can write about sex. I once taught a writing course, the only time, by the way. And my first day in class, I told my students they could write about anything they wanted with only one caveat. I was not interested in their first sexual experience, their last sexual experience, or any sexual experience in between. And then one golden child raised her hand and said, "But what can I write about then?" She wrote about being told she could not write about her sex life. Anyway, back to Richard Rudd's. The first chapter in Making Love is about his relentless quest to relieve himself of his virginity. The year was 1955. He was a freshman at Yale. He could not make out. He didn't know what to do or how. Those were the days when there were two kinds of women, those who did it and those you married. Your mother and your sister didn't do it. One thought that one's mother didn't even do it after she married your father. Then a friend told Richard Rhodes about two sisters in New York. They were taxi dancers in a dime a dance hall. You have to be my age to remember places like that, but they did exist. You bought tickets 10 to a dollar, and then you picked out a hostess and you danced for about a minute and a half in hopes you would grind her pelvis into yours. They were, Mr. Rhodes writes, at least 40 years old, and their specialty was servicing boys from the Ivy League. Of course, it was a commercial arrangement. Mr. Rhodes got a telephone number. He went to New York and made the call. A fee was agreed upon, an address given. He climbed the stairs to their apartment. I just want to read a few lines from his book here. By the way, he called the sisters Gus and Sally King. So, this is from Making Love. Quote, "The older sister answered the door. Gussie, a great head of bleached hair and a tough face swollen with smoking and booze. Sally was shorter and thicker. We gathered awkwardly in the middle of the room, a double bed in the corner. A doorway to a second room closed off with a curtain, a shallow fireplace with a gas grate, and over the mantel a strip of Yale blue banner, lettered in white. When better women are made, Yale men will make them." Ultimately, Mr. Rhodes and Gus King got it on. There is no need to describe it, although he does at length. When it was over, in his version, Gus King cried. I quote, "Tears welled in her eyes. 'It was your first time,' she said, 'and now you'll find a girl, get married, have babies,'" end quote. Now, I have a little problem with those tears, but that was probably just me. And you might be wondering why I spent so much time in this episode that is so important to Richard Rhodes. I suspect you can probably guess why. Because in 1953, when I was a junior at Princeton, 4 days before my 21st birthday, I had my first sexual experience, and it was with, as I think you probably already have know, it was with Gussie King. And, of course, I wrote about it. In a novel of mine called Vegas, published in 1974. So I beat Richard Rhodes in memorializing the King sisters by 18 years. Except I called the King sisters the Coker sisters and named them Phyllis and Norma. I'll read a couple of paragraphs here from Vegas to compare memories and observations. I had taken all identification from my wallet and 30 extra dollars. And put them in a locker at Grand Central. The locker key was stuck under the tray of a telephone booth with a wad of gum. There was nothing to rob, and if I died like John Garfield in the saddle, I would be unidentifiable and hence not a source of shame to my family in Hartford. Like Judge Crater, I would simply vanish from the landscape. Her apartment was on East 52nd Street, a walk-up. The flat was on the top floor. I rang the bell and climbed the stairs. My feet were like concrete. Phil Coker was waiting on the landing. She looked like Anne of Cleves. She had a square, stocky figure and a face like a gravel pit. I was ready to turn around and race back downstairs. She made virginity seem viable. Anyway, we went inside, and it was obviously the same apartment Richard Rhodes was to visit 2 years later. Again, I quote from Vegas. Quote, it was a nondescript affair of Salvation Army chairs and couches. The only distinctive touch was the number of banners on the wall. Banners from every school in the East. Princeton, Harvard, Cornell, Brown, Williams, Amherst, Dartmouth, Columbia. And there were varsity letters in beer mugs, and a monogram chair from the Harvard Coupe, and photographs of the Whiffenpoofs and the Nassoons. In that one room, there was a history of the Ivy League from the days of the Bonus March on Washington to the McCarthy Army hearings. You notice anything, dear, Phil said? It's very unusual, I said. Nothing from the state universities, Phil said. I don't like boys from the state schools. They're really not gentlemen. I did some rapid figuring. There are approximately 30,000 students in the Ivy League. It seemed enough for Phil Coker to handle without bothering with the Vulgate from the state universities. Now, you can imagine my reaction when I came unexpecting upon Mr. Rhodes' version of the King sisters. Gus and Sally are their real first names, by the way. I couldn't stop laughing. Of course, I compared his experience to mine. He tended to think of it more in terms of an epiphany. Well, I seem to remember its more antic aspects, but that is just a difference in outlook and a difference in those pressures, prejudices, and expectations I mentioned earlier. As it happens, Richard Rhodes and I share the same agent, and his publisher used to be my publisher, so I got his address, and needless to say, I dropped him a note. Incidentally, King is not the real last name of these women. Both my lawyer 20 years ago and Mr. Rhodes' lawyer more recently got very nervous about invasion of privacy and the possibility of a lawsuit. And wouldn't you like to be in the courtroom for that one? Anyway, I wrote him. Dear Mr. Rhodes, I wrote, we share a seminal, no pun intended, experience. Mine antedating yours by 2 years. The experience, of course, is Congress, a wonderful word, an original Congress in both cases, it seems, with the King sisters, Gus and Sally, who I called in my book, Vegas, the Coker sisters, even awarding them new Christian names. Norman Phyllis. I enclose the passages from Vegas. It is a novel, but the sequences in which they appear are as perfect as an imperfect memory, circa 1973, could reconstruct. The dance hall was called the Orpheum, or the Big O, and in my memory, their apartment was in the East 50s, not in Brooklyn or Queens. Now, here's the good part of the letter. Out of curiosity this morning, I checked the telephone book after reading Making Love, and there indeed they are still listed. King, Miss Gus, and King, Miss Sally, 250 East 58th Street, 688-2588. I looked at the telephone. I dialed. I heard a gravelly voice remembered from the past say, hello, and I immediately hung up. They must be over 80. Even close to 90, if indeed it is true, as Vide Vegas, a member of the class of Princeton class of 1935, had knowledge of them in his freshman year, 1931. I pray they are still not practicing their trade. but I wonder how two octogenarian former women of the town support themselves. Perhaps by a trust fund established by those generations of Ivy League boys for whom Miss Gus and Miss Sally were rite of passage. I would love to find out, but I think it might be too sad, especially as one is reaching an age where mortality is on the mind. Perhaps you can send them a copy of Making Love and I a copy of Vegas to show them that in literature they live forever, if only in a Library of Congress catalog number. Miss Gus and Miss Sally were for Richard Rhodes and for me an actual experience. The body in El Salvador was an actual experience. Riding in a helicopter in Vietnam in 1962 was an actual experience, or observation, if you will. I want to know how things work and what they look like. I want to know the weather and how people talk, and you don't find this out without going out and looking for it. Writers are told they must write from actual experience. But what exactly is experience? And is experience based on observation? And is it enough? Earlier, I promised you Henry James, and here he is in this very crucial subject of experience. It's in an essay called The Art of Fiction, and it is a reply to a lecture given in 1884 by an English critic named Walter Besant, a lecture of such impacted stupidity that it really got Henry James's motor running. Besant, in this lecture, had laid down what he called, quote, certain laws of fiction, end quote. And one of those laws was that a writer should only write from experience. For example, he said, and I quote, a young lady brought up in a quiet country village should avoid descriptions of garrison life, end quote. This injunction was like catnip to Henry James. In his reply, he wrote that it would be, quote, difficult to dissent, end quote, from Besant's laws of fictions. But then in a wonderfully Jacobite way, he said it would also be, quote, difficult positively to assent to them because, quote, they are so beautiful and so vague. In other words, he was giving Besant the back of his hand, beautifully, elegantly, but still a rap in the mouth. The young lady living in a village, James said, is only to be a damsel upon whom nothing is lost, to make it quite unfair to declare that you have nothing to say about the military. You see, what Henry James was addressing was that basic question, what is experience? Let me continue with James as he continues to peel the skin from Walter Besant. Experience is never limited, and it is never complete. It is an immense sensibility, a kind of huge spider web of the finest silken threads suspended in the chamber of consciousness and catching every airborne article in its tissue. It is the very atmosphere of the mind. When the mind is imaginative, it converts the very pulses of the air into revelations. And then he gives an example. I remember an English novelist, he writes, a woman of genius, much commended for the impression she had managed to give in one of her tales of the nature and the way of life of French Protestant youth. She had been asked where she had learned so much about this recondite being, end quote. It turned out that her only exposure had been passing an open door where, quote, some of the young Protestants were taking a meal. The glimpse made a picture. It lasted only a moment. But that moment was experience. She was blessed with the faculty with which when you give it an inch takes an L, and which for the artist is of much greater source of strength than any accident of residence or of place in the social scale. The power to guess the unseen from the seen, to trace the implication of things, to judge the whole piece by the pattern, the condition of feeling life in general so completely that you are well on your way to knowing any particular corner of it. This cluster of gifts may also be said to constitute experience. If experience consists of impressions, it may also be said that impressions are experience. So, Henry James concludes, write from experience, but of course, experience as he defines it, and most importantly, quote, try to be one of the people on whom nothing is lost, end quote. Try to be one of the people on whom nothing is lost. For a writer, that single sentence is like the Ten Commandments or the Sermon on the Mount. I should say here that I don't think one should ever try to top Henry James. And so I will hand over the rest of this lecture to my wife. Thank you.
This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. It's Joan Didion and John Donne this time. Here they are again in 1992.
I just wish to say one thing. If you see me dash up and pound Joan in the back during the course of this lecture, it's not wife abuse. She's a dreadful case of the flu. And so,
John was talking about one kind of observing and seeing, and I'm going to talk about another kind, which is the kind you do when you're reporting. I want to begin by telling you about something that happened during a presidential campaign. Now, this evening I'm going to tell you about didn't happen during this campaign, although several hundred exactly like it did happen, and I was even present for some of them. But by this campaign, I was too inured to this kind of thing to bother to write it down. The evening I want to tell you about took place before the California primary in 1988, when I was following Jesse Jackson's campaign for a few days. About 11 o'clock on this particular June evening in 1988, I found myself at a housing project in South Central Los Angeles called Nickerson Gardens. Now, this had been on the Jackson campaign a really long day. It had begun three time zones back. So we were all of us, by the time we got to this housing project, Nickerson Gardens, tired of the day. Now, the Nickerson Gardens event was referred to on the bus as a meet and greet and was listed on the schedule this way. 10 p.m., meet and greet Nickerson Gardens family. 10:30 p.m., press availability in front of house. R-O-N, meaning rest of night or remain overnight. Jackson overnights with family. Press overnights at Hyatt Wilshire. Not, in short, much of an evening on the news front. We might as well have gone to Billings. Nor were we even the first to arrive at Nickerson Gardens. There were already snipers on the roofs, ready to watch over Jesse Jackson as he overnighted with the family, which is to say, the single mother and her three children. There was already a SWAT team. There was already a correspondent from KNBC doing a stand-up. This is one of the largest and most dangerous housing projects in the city. Tonight, however, it is quite secure. It was not only secure that night, it was downright cozy. Is this Watts, members of the traveling press kept asking me, and would it be safe to call this neighborhood gang-ridden? What's the story on the meet and greet? Somebody asked the campaign press officer, whose name was Denise Lee. As I understand this meet and greet, it's about the need for daycare, Denise Lee said. Once again, identifying the issue for those of us too tired to figure it out for ourselves. There's this single mother, see, and she wants to become a cosmetician or something, but she has three children, so she can't, which points up, you know, the need for daycare. So we all milled around, and there were these very bright lights, and there were people doing interviews, and other people waiting to be interviewed like actors waiting for cues. The entire tableau, in fact, looked not like a housing project in gang-ridden South Central Los Angeles, but like a set for a housing project in gang-ridden South Central Los Angeles. Which, of course, is precisely what, for the moment, it was. Everyone had his or her lines. Everyone delivered them. Or if the lines got muffed, they tended to get filled in anyway, because we all knew the play. We knew the storyline. We knew the narrative at hand. We knew the narrative because we had brought it with us. We knew the narrative because Denise Lee had told it to us. The narrative was about a single mother who wanted to work as a cosmetician but was on welfare instead because she had no daycare. The single mother was introduced. Her name was Denise, too, Denise Calhoun. She was 27 years old, and she had three daughters, aged 6, 5, and 2. Denise Calhoun's story seemed, as the reporters questioned her, notably less issue-oriented than Denise Lee's version, and more ambivalent. "Do you want to work?" I recall someone asking her. I wrote down her answer. "Well, I have the children to take care of." "But if there was daycare," someone asked, "would you work then?" Her answer was doubtful. "Well," I wrote down, and then she trailed off. "The daycare," she said. And then she trailed off again. "There's things going on in this world," she said. "I mean, it's hard to let your kids..." That was the extent of her answer. Now, this was interesting. In the abstract, Denise Calhoun wanted to be, as Denise Lee had said, a cosmetician or something. Maybe she had mentioned it around the project. Maybe she had mentioned it to whoever on the Jackson staff had advanced the overnight stay. But being a cosmetician or something was in the abstract. And Denise Calhoun was not living in the abstract. She was living except for this moment out of time when we arrived on the set with our cameras and our lights and our middle-class narrative, our real life. In this real life she was living, there were three little girls, and she wanted to take care of them. Now, right there that evening, in a few words that did not exactly reflect the narrative on which the event was based, Denise Calhoun had suggested some of the ambivalence and doubt that people faced with real problems feel about their situation, some of the conflicts that make such problems so generally intractable. Still, when the event was mentioned over the next several days in the papers or on television, this doubtfulness or ambivalence did not often find its way into the story. Here was the New York Times, June 3, 1988, quote, "Mr. Jackson arrived in Los Angeles Wednesday from New Jersey to deliver to address a late afternoon rally in Watts that drew a surprisingly small crowd of about 700. Well, just between the lines, it is very hard to get 700 people on the street in Watts for anything less than a riot, I'm going to say. Quote, "Last night, following a fundraising event in Washington, in Hollywood, Mr. Jackson returned to Watts to spend the night in the Nickerson Gardens apartment of Denise Calhoun, a single 27-year-old mother of three daughters. Standing outside the doorway of her modest two-bedroom home, Ms. Calhoun said she was struggling to get off welfare. Quote, "But there's no daycare," she said quietly. "If I got a job, who would take care of my little girls?" Unquote. The official story on Denise Calhoun, in other words, was not exactly her own narrative, but one laid out by Denise Lee. And because the official story doesn't mention Denise Lee, it's a little tiny lie. Taking the long view obligates the writer to think the story through, worry it, pull something interesting out of, as it were, yesterday's newspaper, yesterday's story. Taking the long view obligates the reporter to look at the edges and the underside of what the Daily Reporter might consider the story. Taking the long view obligates the writer to listen, in other words, not only to Denise Lee's narrative, but also to Denise Calhoun's. And what happened at Nickerson Gardens that night in June 88 was, of course, not an important story. And what story there was, the 1988 Jackson campaign slogging doggedly on in its dying days, had nothing really to do with Denise Calhoun. Nothing rose or fell on what she really thought about daycare. No careers would be made or broken on her story. Most reporters who were there that evening would quite rightly call my dwelling on Denise Calhoun frivolous because I did not have to write the story. It was not on deadline, did not have to file the next day or even the next week. In fact, that was the first week of June, and I didn't have to commit whatever thoughts I had about that campaign to paper until the last week of August, after the Republican convention. This is really an unthinkable luxury. Yet the evening troubled me, even raised what still seems to me the only ethical question a writer faces, and I say ethical guardedly. Discussions of journalistic ethics are always a little mysterious to me, maybe because I have quite a straight-line approach. It seems to me that there is, for a writer or for a journalist, only one ethical question, which is this: am I writing down what I saw? Am I telling all I know? Am I telling the reader what I believe to be true? And finally, and this is the tricky part or way of asking the question, am I letting the reader know in some accurate way where I stand so that the reader can accurately judge for himself or herself whether I'm seeing what he or she would have seen in the same circumstance? Now, I say that this is the tricky part of the question because most of our press conventions rest on not letting the reader know where the writer stands, on not expressing opinion or bias, on, in other words, a quite spurious objectivity. Now, don't misread me. I admire objectivity very much indeed. But I don't see how it can be achieved if the reader doesn't understand the writer's particular bias. Writers are people. They have opinions. They have attitudes. And the fact that these opinions and attitudes too often remain unspoken, unadmitted, but very clearly there, tends to come between the page and the reader like so much marsh gas. Now, if you believe your assigned task is to give the reader an accurate report of what you saw, to put the reader on the scene, in your place, then all the other ethical questions kind of fall into place. Everything flows from that one commandment, which is to tell the truth, report the scene, render the situation as it is. Now, on the face of it, this seems so elementary, but it isn't really. It requires, in the first place, a considerable amount of respect for the reader, a belief that the reader has the right to know exactly what the reporter knows. Now, this respect for the reader, again, appears to be and may well be too often the luxury of those of us who don't write for daily consumption. The problem with a narrative is that it gets between the reporter and the situation. The case I'm making is simply for a kind of reporting that gives us the situation, tells us exactly what the reporter saw and what he or she thought was going on. I want a kind of reporting that tells me what everybody was saying. Now, this, incidentally, was the reason to report on the extramarital affairs of the candidate I mentioned. Not because he was or was not having them. Not because whether he was or was not having them was in the least a matter in which the public had any legitimate interest. But because the discussion of this had begun to dominate discussion of the candidate in Washington, which was where what was being said was going to count, which was where it would be decided whether or not this candidate would be his party's nominee. I want a kind of reporting that tells me exactly what everybody was doing. I remember a story in the Los Angeles Times by Charles T. Powers, who was then in the Times' New York bureau, about the night Son of Sam was arrested. You saw in this story all the people milling around police headquarters. You saw Rune Arledge, quote, dressed as if for a touch football game, a glass of scotch in one hand, a portable two-way radio in the other, directing his network's feed to the coast, unquote. Now that one image tells me more about celebrity police work than anything I've ever read. You could write a novel from Rune Arledge at police headquarters the night Son of Sam was arrested. I want a kind of reporting that tells me exactly what everything looks like. I didn't begin to understand Beirut until I read several years ago, again, this was the Los Angeles Times because that just happens to be one of the papers I read, that at certain times of year, the sun in Beirut comes up at 3:30 in the morning. It's a city under siege and the sun is up at 3:30 in the morning. That was a staggering idea. I want, in other words, a kind of daily and weekly journalism that shares at least a little more than it sometimes seems to share now, both the luxury and the obligation of the kind of journalism that is called literary. The luxury, of course, is a kind of mixed blessing. The downside of the luxury is you just spend too much time writing, you don't get out enough. Where the unmixed blessing lies, however, is in the obligation, in having to think the story through, in having to worry it, in having to reject the conventional wisdom, the conventional narrative, in having to cover the elephant, to look at the edges, at Rune Arledge at police headquarters, and at the sun coming up at 3:30 in the morning in a city already overheated, overfevered. In having to pull something interesting out of yesterday's news, yesterday's story, because sometimes, once in a while, if you're very, very, very lucky and very, very diligent, and you're forced to remember yesterday's story, you discover that today's story isn't quite the way they're telling it to you. And you end up not telling the little tiny lies. Thank you.
That was Joan Didion and John Dunn in Portland, 1992. You've been listening to Literary Arts, The Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, and The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. I hope you can join us next time. The Archive Project is a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. We have all our talks online. You can browse through them at literary-arts.org. Spencer Raymond produces The Archive Project for radio. Thanks for joining us.